This is an experiment. It's an experiment about how we can define ourselves, how we can learn to live in a world that may be visited by extraterrestrials, and how we can live in a universe where we're not the only sentient life form.
Wendy's Coffee House. Hello, I'm Wendy. And this is from the archives. I wanted to bring it back because the timing is actually perfect for this. And given some of the interviews I've done, it kind of dovetails and suggests that there's more going on here than just a UFO sighting. People who have connected are talking more about the images that they see that might be falling under different categories. This goes beyond the nuts and bolts. These are orbs. These are images. These are colors. These are impressions. These are different kinds of actual contact, interaction, not just looking at something, but being a part of a communication.
Surveys have shown that the higher the level of education, the higher the level of belief in the probability that we're being visited.
Dr. Joseph Birks, Stories from the Contact Underground. How did you find a calling to go out and try and contact ETs?
I think because I was a peace and social justice activist for the 20 years before I found out about the UFO subject. I've been active in the doctors' peace movement called International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and that won the Nobel Prize in 1985 for efforts to bring Soviet and American doctors together. Before that, I was active in the student movement to end the war in Vietnam, and going back even further, back into the 60s, believe it or not, there were anti-nuclear weapons testing movements all around the world where women were aroused to defend their children, and they marched against nuclear testing. And I, as a little boy, marched with my mom, and as the physician Helen Caldicott, who headed our anti-nuclear weapons movement, said you can never underestimate the power of women when they are aroused. And there were a lot of mothers out there who were fighting to stop nuclear testing. So that was my political background. But when I found the UFO subject, I was already in my 40s, had a wife with two lovely kids, a big mortgage on the west side of Los Angeles. I needed a hobby because we were going through a housing project that had run awry, and we were out in Los Angeles with no roof on our house because the contractors had messed things up and it was starting to rain. And I said, my God, I'm going to need a hobby. That's what they say when you're in trouble and you need a distraction. You got to have a hobby. So I went to the library and picked up a book on, I don't know, I said, what do you got? And they showed me a book on UFOs. So I started to read, and all of a sudden I'd never really read a book or article about the subject, though I had seen all the television, you know, programs and flying saucers and things, Close Encounters. So I started reading one book after another, and then a year later, I went to my first UFO meeting. Perhaps that was my first big mistake. In any case, I met a tall, bearded, blonde doctor with glasses who looked like he could have been my cousin. His name was Dr. Stephen Greer, and he had this is what he called Citizens Diplomatic Program to contact the intelligence behind the UFO phenomena. And since I had a background in people-to-people diplomacy, citizens diplomacy, traveling to the Soviet Union 5 times and meeting with Soviet doctors, I figured, well, I'll give it a try. And that was perhaps my second mistake, because it started an adventure that is still going on right now. The idea of being able to use consciousness, mind, meditation, to communicate or facilitate communication with extraterrestrial life forms or the intelligence behind the UFO phenomena was an exciting prospect. But what I didn't expect was, as soon as I started the work, contact occurred. There were all kinds of sightings that occurred in the sky and developments on the ground, too, that indicated that a non-human intelligence associated with the UFO phenomena was interacting with us on an ongoing basis. And that's how I got started.
Well, you talk about in the book, this is just a small segment of your experience, but in the book, Paths to Contact, you share stories about the lights that were flashing and trying to figure this out. And at this point, you're just like a neophyte. This is all brand new, and the possibility that this could have happened so quickly and so intensely had to have blown you away.
Well, it was pretty amazing. It was September 1992. I had a very high power team in terms of education and income. We had three physicians on our team. We had two PhD psychologists, a successful writer in the movie industry, a 747 pilot for United Airlines, Captain Joe Vallejo. So we had people who were very educated in their own areas of expertise, and we were out there meditating, and these lights showed up. Actually, they showed up as we were leaving the site. They were not really UFOs in the sense they were up in the air, but they were on a ridge line about a quarter of a mile away, and they started signaling at us. And what happened was one of the people in the team, I call him Mark, he was the screenwriter in Hollywood, he suggested I use a certain kind of pattern to see if I can get the attention of those lights. So the pattern was flash, wait 3 seconds, double flash, wait 3 seconds, another flash, flash, flash. And what happened was these were primitive lights that I was using. When you release your finger on what was called the light bazooka, kind of an appropriate name for people who are trying to peacefully interact with extraterrestrials, when I released the trigger, it took about a second or two for the light to fade out. As soon as I released the trigger from this very powerful light, half a million candle power, I got an immediate reply. It was a strobe. And I waited 3 seconds, two flashes, and again, immediate, strobe-like. It was almost like there was a circuit connecting me with the light. And waited 3 seconds, flash, 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 from my signal lantern. And again, this very anomalous light on the ridge line that was about 2 to 3 feet across, and was accompanied by another light that was signaling across the San Fernando Valley. What we found was that there was clear evidence in my mind of a consciousness connection. We could not reproduce that level of interaction with signaling with our primitive lights. And that was, quite a remarkable experience, but there were others as well. There was red orbs that were flying up and down, sort of like peekaboo over the ridge line, and they did not respond to our light work. And there were anomalous occurrences on the ground. We had lightning-like flashes that turned night into day. This was, in September in the high desert outside of Chatsworth in the San Fernando Valley. And all of a sudden, a flash of light, and if you had your eyes open, and you could see everything around, it was daylight. And then the flash was over, and other kinds of things occurred that no one had ever experienced before, including, the 747 pilot and all the other contact workers that were in my team.
That blinding flash, sometimes you see things afterwards to know that, okay, this was intense and makes a physical impact. Did you have anything like that?
Well, I think the physical impact was not so much of what was happening in the field work, but it was in the course of preparation for field work. And it wasn't just physical, it was mental, emotional, maybe even spiritual, because the protocols involve meditation. And the explanation of how meditation facilitates contact with non-human intelligence is the idea that consciousness, mind, it has the property of non-locality. It's not limited by time and space. And so because of that connection, we can reach out to other life forms and interact with them at the level of mind. As part of that discipline, I started to meditate regularly, and I noticed that I had lost completely my desire to eat meat. I'd been a meat and potato man all my life. So, in fact, my wife and I and my son, we all took a course in TM, Transcendental Meditation. My son thought it might help improve his guitar playing because, that was then give him a little spiritual edge on the other guitar players. In any case, I had no desire to eat meat. I was meditating. I was hiking, looking for research sites all across the high desert. And that spare tire, from sitting at the doctor's desk for 20 years at that point, the 20 pounds melted away. My back pain got better. These were physical changes that happened not so much because I was out in the field, but because I was preparing to do field work and there weren't sacrifices, but all the discipline of that kind of work following a protocol. So I used to kid my colleagues who were on my team, and I'd say, if this contact thing doesn't work, we can sell it as a self-improvement course. Like we could put out, you too can meditate vector and spacecraft and also lose 20 pounds, be healthier, stronger, and a new you. it was, you know, a bit of a joke, but we had a chuckle about that. So,
when you're talking about learning how to meditate and focus differently, you're getting a lot of the monkey mind out of the way and becoming very concrete in your thinking and what you're focusing on.
And it was a delight. There was a playful quality to many of the interactions. All the people on the team were totally convinced that what we were doing was, you know, not just for personal knowledge, but it was part of what you might call a higher calling, that we wanted to have some kind of sustainable relationship with this intelligence, that our intentions were peaceful, and we were hoping that we would be part of a worldwide effort, not just in Los Angeles, where the first teams were started in Phoenix, Arizona, and Los Angeles, and also Colorado. Our initial teams, we imagined, would be perhaps part of a worldwide effort. This was before I learned the existence of Rama, and they had a worldwide effort that was, you know, quite sophisticated in many ways, far more advanced than what we were doing, you know, in Los Angeles and across the West.
Well, they've been doing it longer.
Yes. The 1974 was when Rama was established. Contact experience of Sixto Paswells, who was a young university student in Lima, and he attracted to him a core of very dedicated contact activists. They used automatic writing as a way of communicating. And one of the first sessions he had, he was kind of, his father had been interested in UFOs. Sixto Paswells' friends came to his house, and he was writing and communicating with a being that identifies itself as Oxalt, O-X-A-L-T, A-L-C-T, Oxalt. And this being was able to work through Sixto, and one of the people in the audience said, well, how do we know you're an extraterrestrial? You could be some other kind of spirit. And the consciousness that was working through Sixto responded through automatic writing, well, let's arrange a meeting. And they set a date, and these young people went out to a place called Chilca, which is about 70, 80 kilometers from Lima, out in the Peruvian desert. And to their amazement and actually initial terror, because they really weren't prepared for what happened, a hamburger-shaped UFO 90 feet across came out from behind a mountain with a brilliant light, and they panicked. They were not well prepared. And the lesson that Sixto Paswells experienced and his team was the same lesson that we were going to have to go through in terms of being disciplined, following a spiritual program, and embracing a paradigm of oneness, acceptance of the unity of all life and all things, all consciousness in the universe. And that is a good prescription for doing away with much fear, embracing the paradigm of oneness.
When you started this, again, this is a couple decades ago, how have you changed since beginning this journey?
Well, my ideas about the phenomena changed from sheer delight to a more introspective one and a critical one. Because the intelligence behind the phenomena, in retrospect, in my opinion, seemed intent on showing me the mechanisms of contact, how they carried out what I believe is perhaps a long-term mission to interact with humanity, to shape the belief systems on our planet. And one of the mechanisms they use is the creation of illusion. And this is not a hallucination. The people in our teams were seeing things, anomalous lights in the sky, structured objects, but we're also seeing things that were impossible. Shooting stars that zigzagged, shooting stars that went from low in the sky up, shooting stars that could actually appear on request, which is an amazing contact experience, which hopefully we'll be able to talk about later on the show. And so the first week I was doing contact work, I was driving back from my office in the San Fernando Valley. I was getting on the 405 freeway, and I saw something in the air that was impossible. It was, for want of a better term, looked like a prop in a circus. It was a small wooden single-winged aircraft that was painted fire engine red with lightning, yellow lightning bolts on it. The wings were so short, I couldn't see how it was able to stay up in the air. It was about 100 feet up going north over the freeway as I was getting on going south. And it looked like a prop that in the circus, a dozen clowns who are little people climb out of as part of a comedy routine. It was impossible. Shouldn't have been able to fly. There was an open canopy, and there was no pilot. And there was no, the very beginning, they were showing us that they create illusion. And that started me on the process that eventually led a decade later with my understanding that the principal mechanism of contact is the creation of illusion. They can create hologram-like visual displays in the sky that are not objects but can appear to be objects. They can also, and this is more from the literature rather than my own personal experience, but in reading the literature, I discovered that they can also create what, for want of a better term, is like virtual reality, where a person can have a full sensory contact experience in real time that's illusory, but it seems as real as what we're doing right now, talking on the radio, or people listening. And the third mechanism is virtual memory, where this intelligence can impregnate into your consciousness memories that don't represent necessarily events that occurred in the past. And this is something also described in literature. John Mack, colleague, Dr. John Mack, a psychiatrist at Harvard, who I met as part of the physicians' peace movement in Moscow in 1985, and he was a big hero to the young doctors in the peace movement back then because of his work on the psychology of the Cold War and the impact of the Cold War was having on children. John Mack, in his book on abduction, noted that spontaneous recollections of dreams that people suddenly started remembering that they had 10, 20, 30 years before during their childhood. The sudden remembering of dreams that had to do with the contact experiences. This seems likely that they can create a virtual memory. So this is kind of scary stuff because we live in a culture that's heavily invested in control issues. If some of you are thinking about maybe the habits of a friend or a mate that's always trying to control things, and it's really an illusion of control, but we're heavily invested in that. And here we're faced with some kind of super intelligence that can create illusions. It can create virtual reality and even contact in the form of memory that doesn't represent physical events. This is scary stuff for some people because these capabilities to affect our consciousness and shape belief systems it can potentially undermine all religion.
Giving these different scenarios that are impressed upon someone, is that some kind of an experiment, do you think?
Well, if it's an experiment, it may be lasting for not decades, but hundreds or even thousands of years. My wife used to tell me all the time, we don't really know what the UFOs are. She has a great term for them. She calls them the whatevers, whatever. We don't know who the whatevers are, and she's right. They control every aspect, practically every aspect of the contact experience. What they don't totally control is how we're going to feel about it. So what I learned by talking it over, my contact experience with her, that this was really an exercise or experiment in learning about ourselves. We had a choice to how we were going to react. We could react like the Sixto Paz Wells friends when they initially became so frightened, running around like chickens with their heads as this powerful light came down from a 90-100-foot saucer, or we can look into ourselves, overcome our fear, and we can define who we are by the way we interact with this phenomenon. So there are people who are in the military-industrial complex who interact with the ETs. They try to shoot them down. And there's a long hidden history of armed conflict between this intelligence. There are many allegations of shoot-downs and crash saucers. I suspect some of those stories are true. So we can react. The joke that I like to tell is about the mythical Southern colonel who, during the 50s, when they had the beginning of the flying saucer modern era, he said, why don't we shoot down some of those flying discs and see if they're friendly or not? And one response is violence. And the other response is an offer of friendship. So your point is well taken. If this is an experiment, it's an experiment about how we can define ourselves, how we can learn to live in a world that may be visited by extraterrestrials, and how we can live in a universe where we're not the only sentient life form.
Maybe it's a test of taking our temperature and seeing if we are evolving and watching us as we grow until they at some point decide that maybe we're worthy of a little bit more definitive type of contact. But I think contact is happening all over. I wanted to also get into your background. You've worked also with the Rama Group. You're working with MUFON. I think people who are listening are more interested in can it be self-initiated? Now, for myself, I didn't start out wanting to do that. It happened first, and I thought, well, okay, if this happened without me asking for it, then what else is possible? And it didn't involve going anywhere or learning any kind of protocol. It just happened. The meditating was maybe a trigger, because that's something that it's very helpful. It helps you sort fact from fiction, because you know what you were thinking. And when you're very intentional in having one thought and all of a sudden this other thing comes in and says, oh, by the way, we're here. See ya. That changes things. True stories from the Contact Underground. Dr. Joseph Burks.
This, you asked the question, what comes first? You know, it's the proverbial challenge. What comes first, the chicken or the egg? Because this intelligence is totally telepathic, it can access your consciousness, I believe, even when you're not directly aware of it.
Wendy's Coffee House. Hello, I'm Wendy. My guest is Dr. Joseph Burks. Stories from the Contact Underground. There are more people having these encounters, or at least more people are now sharing them. Meditation helps.
Meditation is about more than just sitting quietly and emptying your mind. It also leads to a spiritual path that can inform us as to how we can live better in terms of identifying the ego, the source of the monkey mind thoughts that are in our mind. And it can change us for better in terms of being more compassionate and following a spiritual, any one of the spiritual traditions out there. For the people in Rama, they were heavily influenced by Catholicism, because Latin America is. Here in the United States, New Age theories abound, and people are looking to Zen Buddhism. And so when I studied the spiritual literature, I gravitated to the Buddhism. And I, as a result of my contact work, I'd like to think that I became a better person. And certainly I'm watching the ego and watching my thoughts. And so I think that touches on the fact that contact work can lead to many changes, spiritual, mental, as well as losing 20 pounds in my spare tire.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Okay, there's this other little physical vanity factor that kind of plays into it. See, you'll look a whole lot better.
In LA, they say, in Los Angeles, they say it's better to look good than to feel good.
Dr. Joseph Burks, contact.
After one has experienced telepathy, not necessarily a voice in your head, because direct telepathic communication is something that certain contact activists experience, but it takes many years of preparation. And those are people that I call prime contactees. They're people like Sixto Paz-Wells, or perhaps Dr. Stephen Greer, for sure. And also, I was sent, for want of a better term, the one I coined as a prime contactee, manifested in my emergency room. I was working at Kaiser Panorama City for, gosh, it was at least 12, 15 years, and this young man shows up as an EKG tech, and I recognized from his accent he was from Russia, and I was surprised that he actually came from a city not far from where my grandparents came, and we both were Jewish and from Eastern Europe, although, you know, I'm third generation in the U.S., and he said to me, what do you think of UFOs? And I didn't know who this person was. I said, well, there's so much space out there. If we were the only ones, it would be a terrible waste of space. Later on, in fact, a year later, he told me that he had been a lifelong contactee. He had memories of onboard experiences. And one of the UFO dreams that he had a dream where he would emigrate to the United States, be working in a hospital, and he would meet a tall, bearded, Jewish American doctor, and he actually got to see in his dream the person. And several years later, when he emigrated, he got a job in the ER. And in this dream, he was told he would be doing UFO work with this person. And So he showed up. I call him Misha. That's not his real name. I use a Mikhail. This is nom de guerre, or nom de plume, pseudonym. He looked at me, and there I was, the man of his dream, which when I heard about it, I was kind of perplexed. When I was young, Dr. Burks, before I got married, I'd always wanted to be the man of the dreams of, you know, beautiful nurses. Or, you know. And here I was, the man of the dream of, you know, this kind of heavy-set Russian Jewish guy who 21 years old. But he was clearly a prime, because as soon as he joined our team, the level of contact went way up. And, you know, during the early years of Dr. Greer's career, he could not go anywhere without UFOs showing up. He was kind of a magnet, or as the Rama people would say, he was a good antenna as well as receiving messages. Well, my friend Misha, we started doing field work, and all of a sudden, I'm getting telepathic overrides telling me in advance when we're out in the desert meditating, or in Topanga Canyon State Park, I would be meditating, and I would get a download of information where I was informed the level of knowledge when, where in the sky, and how many UFOs were going to show up during that night of field work. We had been alerted by Dr. Greer that this might happen, and we were advised to share that information in advance. And sure enough, as I had been informed on one of our sessions out in the field in Joshua National Monument, up there on 4,000 feet elevation in the high desert, I got a telepathic override. I was told, showtime, 2 o'clock, 2 a.m., well, one craft coming from the northwest. And sure enough, at 2 o'clock on the dot, a red glowing UFO appeared in the northwest, totally silent, moved past us at a bleak angle, and then changed direction slightly and said due east across the desert at maybe 600-700 miles an hour, totally silent. So what we experienced was a kind of mental communication, not a voice in the head, but something that was verifiable. And so meditation became incredibly practical because it facilitated the effort. But it's not just sitting there trying to empty your mind. There are meditation equivalents. People who are engaged in music or art, they have a meditation equivalence, and contact is facilitated perhaps even at a subconscious level in individuals who are able to access that quiet place where perhaps all creativity comes when they're engaged in the arts, the music, you know, as musicians. And this, you ask the question, what comes first? You know, it's the proverbial challenge. What comes first, the chicken or the egg? Because this intelligence is totally telepathic, it can access your consciousness, I believe, even when you're not directly aware of it. If you have 10% of the population that says that they've had a sighting of a UFO, and this is a statistic that is borne out all over the world, the question is, are all those random sightings random? I came to the conclusion they are not. They are staged events. So we have now potentially hundreds of millions of people who have perhaps a long-standing relationship with this phenomena by virtue of the fact that they've seen something that they thought was totally impossible, a UFO. So this gives you an idea of the dimensions of the contact drama that's unfolding. For us, it was, we imagined that we were carrying out human-initiated contact. But if you look back at the history of the people involved, they seem to, each one of them had a particular activity that facilitated contact. For me, perhaps it was my humanitarian efforts, both as a doctor and in the physician's anti-nuclear movement. For other people, it's years of meditation. For other people, it can be music. And this is something that was kind of brought home to me in very sharp terms, because during the first month of our contact work, three of us in the team or closely associated with the team had sightings under highly congruent circumstances, not during field work, but when we were separately driving around Southern California at night or in the evening, we had sightings of UFOs, and they were quality sightings. One was a metallic disc hovering over the Santa Monica Mountains, and another person, Dotha Wayburn, who's passed away since then, but she was an experienced yachtswoman, traveled all around the world. She knew the sky very well from navigating, and as she's driving, she was a wealthy woman, as she's driving up this 300-foot driveway to her palatial estate on Palos Verdes Peninsula after leaving a meditation class. A glowing 30-foot mother-of-pearl UFO is hovering above her house, and it flies above the driveway down as if to meet her. And as it passes her, she gets the thought, well, you were looking for us? Well, here we are. And the sighting that I have was somewhat less dramatic, but I just finished giving a passionate talk about the excitement of being in a human-initiated contact team, what's called the CE5 Initiative, by people in North America or English-speaking countries. And I went to this meeting with old guard ufologists who were trying to tell me, well, we don't know whether these are extraterrestrial, they're anomalous lights, and we call them unknowns. And I, of course, was very full of myself. I had been doing contact work for a month, you know. And so I thought, oh, I'm an expert. And I said, well, I thank you people for your contributions. They were older, 50s, 60s, 70s. And I said, but we have a new program, and we're going to have human-initiated contact. And in real time, we're going to carry out our investigations rather than just interviewing people about theirs. I thought I did very well, but people there were somewhat offended, and they didn't told me it would be better if I never came back to any of their meetings. But as I'm driving home, this anomalous blue-green light appears over the 405 freeway, and I'm heading south. And as I'm emerging from the Sepulveda Pass, it just flies by in a kind of undulating way just above the ridge line where you enter from the San Fernando Valley into the spectacular L.A. Basin. So it seemed as if there was a message in these staged sightings. One, for Dotha, it was she had just left a meditation class. Myself, I had just given a passionate support of trying to establish human-initiated peaceful relations with whatever the intelligence is behind UFOs. And the third person who had a sighting was the wife of one of my colleagues. I call her Dr. Maria. She's an immunologist, an internist at the Panorama City. She prefers I not use her real name. She had a sighting, similar circumstances, driving home alone, and she saw metallic glittering UFO, a disc, hovering above the Santa Monica Mountains while she's driving home alone, as it was the case with Dotha and myself. We're separate. But she was not even in the team yet. She was the wife of Dr. Daniel, who was also a colleague in Kaiser. He's an internist and family practitioner. And she had this very high-quality sighting of a structured object in broad daylight, and she was not even on the team yet, although after she had her sighting, she quickly wanted to do the contact work. And I said, well, why was Maria having a sighting? She's not even in the team. A couple of weeks later, I was at a meeting at Dr. Daniel and Maria's house. We had business meetings and sort of debrief on what we've been doing in terms of the contact work. We were all together, and the phone rang, and this is before cell phones, and I had to call the hospital. And we were at a meeting in the afternoon, and I said, well, where can I take this call so I don't, disturb the meeting? And they said, well, you can go to the family room. But Maria was an accomplished harpist, and she was playing harp. And I said, I don't want to go in the family room. And Dr. Daniel said, oh, no, that's fine. Maria, when she's in the playing her music, she's like in a trance. You won't disturb her. You can call and talk on the phone. It won't bother her a bit. And then it clicked in my mind that her music was the meditation equivalent. She was practicing accessing consciousness in its most unbounded form, not by sitting and making your mind go blank, but by creating beautiful music. Always the question is, which came first? Did they reach out to us in a sighting or in a dream or when we're asleep? Or did we reach out to them first? In any case, it was delightful when they continued to show up for us during the subsequent 4 years of field work that I did during the 1990s when I was an activist in C-SETI.
You've shifted directions now, and now you're really going, you're trying to get a collective involvement in a new way of approaching this intelligence.
Yes, there's power in numbers, and there's also security in numbers. It can be potentially frightening to reach out to an unseen intelligence that is telepathic and can manifest visual displays in the sky that look like very powerful craft. That the if some of these UFOs are more than just holographic-like projections, but are actually craft with physical beings on, their technology and their power is awesome. And here we are, you know, human beings being contacted by this potentially very powerful force. So fear is always an issue, and one way of overcoming fear is to have the support of your fellow humans out there in the field to reassure one another that we're together in this effort. And the signal of good intent, wanting peace and cooperation, I believe is magnified when you work in a coherent team. And one of the terms we used to describe the imagery and meditations that we did was coherent thought sequencing. So there's a way of coordinating your meditation so that you perhaps are even more attractive working in a group than you are as an individual.
Some of the members also having a little bit more eloquent way of connecting or interfacing, maybe is a good word with it, because they bring others to the equation automatically because of their energy.
I think likes do attract likes. If you go in a spirit of peace, you're going to attract intelligences that will be more willing to interact with you in that spirit. If you try to shoot them down, which is what a big part of the secret history of the UFO scene is, if you see them as a enemy, you're not going to get the same kind of friendly interactions that we got. There happened allegations of pilots going up against the UFOs and being killed. I was trying to shoot them down. So
yeah, and some of that stuff is coming out with this freedom of information. I mean, a lot of the countries across the world are releasing their documents and their background and their history, their interaction, their engagement, the successes in terms of having shot something down might be a little bit more cloudy because not all of that information is accessible. But there are others who say it is here and it's a matter of time before we get to it. What's so, I think, contradictory in what you're pointing out? We set this thing out, what was it, back in the 70s, Carl Sagan, that was part of this thing that we sent out, this wonderful little disc that said, hi,
yeah, space,
UFO people, ETs, come see us, we want to see you. Mm-hmm. And then the minute they get here, we go, boom.
It's shoot first, ask questions later. If advanced extraterrestrials are the source of UFOs, then they probably evolved not only technologically, but in the course of getting here, they've evolved culturally, and I believe probably spiritually. So the idea of trying to reach out to a race of beings whose main occupation is, as one famous ufologist, Stanton Freeman, said, our main occupation on this planet, it seems to be tribal warfare. For an advanced, spiritually enlightened civilization or group of civilizations to reach out to us, we shoot first and ask questions later, is quite a challenge. And this brings me around to why I find this subject so fascinating, and that is because my background is one of a peace and social justice activist. And so I see a direct connection between the evolution of our society into more cooperative, peace-loving societal forms. I see that progress that I'm hoping to be achieved through political and social action as a precursor and a precondition for open contact. If an advanced civilization has been here for decades or perhaps centuries or millennium and they're a threat to mankind, what's taken them so long to mount an attack? We would have been a far easier foe if they had gone after us thousands of years ago, and there are paintings on the walls of cave dwellings in France and Spain that show images that look very much like UFOs. If they wanted to attack, why not do it when we had bows and arrows or flintlocks 200-300 years ago? Why would they wait for us to have nuclear weapons and heat-guided missiles to attack? So I think that there's evidence to show that the phenomena is peaceful, they're non-hostile, and perhaps, as you suggest, they're waiting for us to evolve to a more cooperative planet. One planet, one people is the slogan is used to describe the sense of global unity. And when we achieve that, then they'll step out from behind the curtain as the Wizard of Oz was stepped out and reveal actually who they are. So I believe that societal progress and reform is a precondition, and that's why I'm working both in the area of social justice and peace as well as in contact.
In my opinion, in my experience, part of their agenda is to seed us with that element of having to upgrade our consciousness, having to become more compassionate, more caring, more in terms of humanity, self preservation focused without killing everything else around us, because that's counterproductive. So I do see it as more of an intentional act on their part by being elusive enough to make us curious and intelligent enough to give us puzzles and problems and challenges and hurdles to prove worth. And I don't mean as in judging us to be lesser, but judging us to be worthy and necessary in terms of a universal cosmic kind of participant, that's where we're going. And they're just giving us a little bit of a jump start.
Right. I think it's good to have friends in high places, especially if they're helping in the evolution of human consciousness. And you know, these are very broad statements. It's very hard to prove any of this. As a physician, as someone who's trained in Western science, I definitely try to pin down what we know for sure in terms of our level of interactions with them, and what we want in terms of our hopes and desires about the future. I can tell you that from being part of dozens and dozens of contact field investigations, they are non-harmful. We've been very close to some of these objects, which, if they are actual physical craft, are sometimes, like in my experiences in Mexico, are hundreds of feet across. There was no one in any of my teams no one was ever hurt or deliberately frightened by the intelligence behind the phenomena. However, the humans, that's another question. When we were down in Mexico, we were shot at by some drunken farmers, I believe, who didn't like us on their field doing contact work. And also, unfortunately, not to sound too James Bondish, but we were also, during the early years, followed around by surveillance teams that appeared to have a military or paramilitary bearing. And this was more related to the work that Dr. Greer was doing with his liaison with people within the government, and less to do with the field work. But we attracted Black Hawk helicopters that buzzed us. That was in Rocky Peak State Park. We attracted people who had a military bearing. There was in Joshua Tree, there was a local Marine base who would be photographing us. We'd show up in the middle of the Queen Valley in Joshua Tree, and there would be a young man who looked like a Navy SEAL, bulging with muscles, running around in shorts, waiting for our arrival in a civilian Jeep. And when we arrived there, no one's in the park, in the middle of winter, he gets out of his vehicle and says something like, I didn't know that I would have company walking, taking a hike in the desert at night. These people, were part of some kind of organized surveillance, in my judgment, having worked in the peace movement and had some encounters with this sort of thing, surveillance. And the reaction of people was not always very positive, as well as the ridicule and denial. I did not do this work until I was well established in my medical group. I was working at Kaiser, from 1979 to 1992 to 92 before I started doing contact work. So my colleagues, whatever they thought about my UFO work, knew that if one of their patients arrived in the emergency room and I was on duty, I was going to do everything possible to make sure they were alive and stable when the doctor came in to round on them in the next morning after I admitted them to the hospital.
So, I don't think a belief in UFOs shows a lack of intelligence. I think you're more willing to open up your mind to what if rather than discount everything because you can't see, touch, or feel it.
This is what surveys have shown, that the higher the level of education, the higher the level of belief in the probability that we're being visited. So,
Paths to Contact, the book. You were co-editor, that was a collaboration. Okay. Did you have a story that you can recommend that stands out in there as, like a top story to go to from that, aside from yours?
I think the Costa Macrius, who's got a group called ET Let's Talk, his narrative is very compelling, describing his contact work. Jeff Becker's account, he was the editor. He and his wife edited all our personal accounts into the anthology that has the name Paths to Contact. So his story stands out. And then there's also Marilyn Alan Brannon and Paula Shirley, because I helped them write their accounts. So I have, you know, I'm very proud of their narratives because I edited their remarks for them.
Again, the book Paths to Contact, True Stories from the Contact Underground, my guest, Dr. Joseph Birx.